You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 16th of April, 2024, on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll be in the Middle East, unpacking the strategy behind Iran's attack on Israel, how the region's responded, and what's likely to happen next. Then we'll catch up on the first day of former President Donald Trump's trial and ask if there could possibly be 12 jurors out there who have no opinions on the man. Plus, we'll hear from a former US Army commander on the laws of engagement in Ukraine and Gaza.
Everybody in the world knows that Hamas is a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. They're brutal. But that doesn't mean that the IDF can then just go ahead and destroy entire houses without confirming that only Hamas are inside of it.
We'll get the latest technology news, check in with the team at Salone del Mobile in Milan, and the Prime Minister is unhappy with the President as Croatians prepare for the polls.
It's an anti-constitutional behaviour. It's bizarre. For us, it's a continuation of an odd behaviour, to be very polite.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Australian police say a knife attack on an Assyrian church bishop and some followers in Sydney was a terrorist act motivated by suspected religious extremism, as the country reeled from a second stabbing incident in 3 days. South Korea's foreign ministry summoned a Japanese diplomat today to protest a claim in Japan's annual diplomatic policy Blue Book over a group of islands between the countries at the centre of a long-standing territorial row. And German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on a 3-day visit to China, his first since his government launched a de-risking strategy last year to avoid tethering Germany too closely to the world's second largest economy. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, as we know, over the weekend, Iran launched an unprecedented direct military assault on Israel in response to a suspected Israeli strike that killed top Iranian officials in Syria. Although there have been many years of proxy warfare, it marked a potential turning point in the Middle East. Israel's war cabinet has met, but has not yet said whether a decision on how to respond has been reached. Well, to discuss this further, I'm joined now by Greg Karlstrom, a Middle East correspondent based in Jerusalem and the author of How Long Will Israel Survive? The Threat from Within. Greg, many thanks for joining us once again on the show. How would you describe the tensions in the region today?
They are, you know, I think about as high as they have been in many, many years. Everyone is anxiously waiting to see how Israel, or if Israel, decides to retaliate for this Iranian strike. I think they almost certainly will do something. The question is what they do. And the Iranians have been very clear that if the Israelis were to respond by carrying out a direct strike on their own territory, it would draw an even harsher Iranian response, they've said, and there's a very real risk of this just continuing to escalate into an even bigger regional conflict.
Everyone knew the Iranian attack was coming. Was the way it happened unexpected?
It was. I mean, you're right. They telegraphed for 2 weeks that there was going to be a response to this Israeli airstrike on their embassy compound in Damascus. But the assumption was that Iran would stick to its longstanding policy of retaliating indirectly, fighting Israel through proxies or perhaps targeting Israeli interests abroad, Israeli diplomatic missions, for example. But I don't think anyone expected that they would do this directly with their own armed forces and at the scale which they did it, with hundreds of missiles and drones that they fired. And when I say no one expected it, that includes the Israeli government, which approved this airstrike on April 1st in Damascus based on an assessment that the Iranians would not directly retaliate for it. And that assessment, of course, turned out to be incorrect.
And of course, these drones coming in that could be seen for miles. I mean, it was really very slow.
It was, and that was, I think, a deliberate choice on the part of the Iranians. So it's not just that we had 2 weeks of notice that there was a response coming, and that gave Israel and its allies time to prepare. It's also that there were hours between when these drones were launched from Iranian territory and when they could actually reach Israel. So it gave ample time to get fighter jets in the air, to prepare air defenses. I think it was choreographed in such a way to minimize somewhat the damage. That's not to say it was entirely symbolic. That's not to say the Iranians didn't plan to cause any death and destruction in Israel. I don't think you fire almost 350 missiles and drones with the assumption that they're all going to be shot down and ineffective, but they were trying to sort of thread the needle between, on the one hand, a muscular response that they hoped would deter Israel and also satisfy a domestic constituency, but on the other hand, not wanting to do something so big that it would trigger an immediate and overwhelming Israeli retaliation.
And do you think this is the type of attack that Iran could repeat? I mean, it must have been astronomically expensive. And equally, on the other side, could Israel respond so effectively without the warning and outside help that it received?
Both of those are questionable, I think. To the latter point about Israel's response, I think it would be very different if Iran had done this with an element of surprise, if we hadn't had 2 weeks. And of course, remember, Israel was quite successful in using its air defenses on Saturday night and Sunday morning, but many of these projectiles were shot down by this ad hoc coalition of America, Britain, France, Jordan, other Arab states that participated. It was a international effort to protect Israel. And if this were to happen by surprise, it would be much harder to replicate that, and air defenses wouldn't be so successful. But on the other hand, I think you're also right to question how often Iran would be able to do this. Things like ballistic missiles in particular, they are a finite resource. Iran only has so many of them. They're expensive and time-consuming to replace. And I don't think they could make this sort of thing into a regular occurrence.
And how would you describe the support of Arab nations towards Israel, particularly Jordan, who joined the defensive effort?
Jordan was crucial for this. They, by all accounts, shot down dozens of drones over their territory. Now, they're presenting this not as a defense of Israel, but as a defense of Jordan's own airspace and Jordan's own citizens. And I think, not surprising, they present it that way. They're sensitive to public opinion in Jordan, which is very pro-Palestinian. And there's no love lost between the Jordanian government right now and the Israeli government. The Jordanians are furious at Israel for the way it has conducted itself in Gaza over the past 6 months. But Jordan is also a country that is very dependent on its relations with Western allies, particularly the United States. And I think they saw an opportunity here to score some points with their Western allies by joining in this defensive effort, by helping to protect Israel. They are banking some credit with the United States and other countries, which they hope to use then down the road.
So, of course, the US says it won't support a counterattack by Israel. Is that enough to deter Netanyahu and his war cabinet?
If that's as far as the Americans have gone in private, is to say that we don't support a counterattack, I'm not sure that's going to be enough. The question is just how tough their warnings have been, if they've threatened consequences, if Israel goes ahead with a rash counterattack. I mean, there's a range of things that Israel could do right now. There's the extreme end of the spectrum, which is carrying out direct attacks on Iranian military facilities or nuclear facilities inside of Iran. But it doesn't have to go that far. It could try for covert action rather than overt airstrikes. It could carry out cyber attacks on critical infrastructure in Iran, or it could choose to strike outside of the country, strike Iranian targets elsewhere in the region, which would have, I think, a much lower risk of escalating this and inviting another tit-for-tat strike by the Iranians. And so that's the focal point of diplomacy right now. I think everyone is assuming that there will be some kind of Israeli reprisal, but they're trying to put some guardrails around exactly what it is Israel chooses to do.
And I wonder how much daylight there is between the thinking of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and the Iranian government, and how much all of this is to do with domestic policy and maintaining the support of the population.
There was a lot of debate about this. I mean, part of the reason it took 2 weeks for Iran to carry out this counterattack is because there were real disagreements at the highest levels of the Iranian government. You have a hardline constituency that was pushing for a strong response, that was frustrated that Iran has absorbed now months and months of attacks on its interests, its military personnel in Syria, without really retaliating against Israel. But you also had a less hardline wing of the government that was very worried that a direct attack on Israel would invite a direct attack on Iran and would bring the war home in a way that Iranian officials wanted to avoid. So there was a real power struggle behind the scenes. And I think ultimately some of it does come down to elite politics. The supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, he's worried about a looming succession. He is old. He's had bouts of ill health. And he is trying to install his son as his successor as supreme leader. To do that, he needs the assent of the Revolutionary Guard and hardline elements in Iran who have really consolidated power in recent years. And those elements are not happy that they've been struck over and over again without a response. And I think part of why he okayed this response in the end is because he needs to keep them on board.
Mm. And finally, Greg, given what happened, does this change the situation in Gaza?
For now, it has pushed the situation in Gaza off the global agenda. I mean, if you think about the conversations we were having a week or two ago, they were about growing outrage around the world, about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the appalling civilian death toll, Israel's refusal to talk about what happens after the war. No one is talking about those things right now. And so it has taken some of the pressure off of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government. And that might be one thing as they're negotiating with their allies right now about what to do. They might sort of try to swap restraint in how they respond to Iran for a bit more freedom to act in Gaza, perhaps going ahead with this Rafah operation that they've been talking about for months.
Greg Karlstrom, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist. It is 7:12 here in London. That's 2:12 in New York. And that's where Donald Trump made history yesterday, becoming the first sitting or former president to go on trial for criminal charges. Monocle's Simon Marks sent this report on the historic achievement.
New York City is in for a long ride now that the trial is underway and the Trump circus has come to town.
USA! USA!
The former president's supporters were on hand outside the court, but his detractors were as well.
This trial was orchestrated by the entire Democrat Party.
Our former embarrassment in chief should be tried for everything that he's responsible for.
Inside the building, jury selection got underway. It's going to take a while. Of 96 initial prospects, more than half were dismissed after saying they couldn't be impartial towards the former president. The presumed Republican presidential candidate watched it all from the accused's table at the front of the court. He pored over documents, at times appeared to take a nap, and after court wrapped up for the day, excoriated the judge for forcing him to sit through it all.
That I can't go to my son's graduation, or that I can't go to the United States Supreme Court, that I'm not in Georgia or Florida or North Carolina campaigning like I should be, it's perfect for the radical left Democrats. That's exactly what they want.
He called the trial a scam. The charges against him are relatively minor, certainly when compared to the other criminal cases he's facing. Accused of falsifying records of his $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels, a conviction could theoretically result in a jail sentence, but few legal analysts think a prison term is likely. The case continues for an estimated 6 weeks, maybe longer. And for the defendant, that is going to mean a lot of time off the campaign trail. For Monocle Radio, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
Many thanks to Simon. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin. Scott, welcome back to the show. Do you think it's possible to find 12 people to serve on a jury who have no opinion on Trump?
Yes, it is, Georgina. I mean, it's done in trials of people who are not quite as prominent on an everyday basis. In the sense that you might have an opinion about Donald Trump, but can you, while holding that opinion, be unbiased while hearing the evidence, while considering if the evidence merits a conviction, in this case on the charge of falsifying business records to interfere in the 2016 election? It will be a lengthy process, as Simon Marks explained. Yesterday, we had the first 96 of 200 jurors who were questioned. In fact, before they were questioned, over half were asked, could they be impartial in considering a verdict on Donald Trump? They raised their hands to say no. They were immediately dismissed. Of the remaining approximately 45 that were there, 11 were questioned by the end of the day.
What will the prosecution be looking for in the jurors?
They're going to be looking for people who I think aren't going to say immediately, oh, he's guilty, because the defense will strike those people, as they rightly should. I think they'll be looking for people who do show a basic knowledge of the of politics, a basic issue of the legal issues that are involved here, who will show a willingness to consider the evidence that's considered. In other words, they're probably looking for the legal equivalent of what you might call the floating voter, someone who has not yet made up a determination on Donald Trump's future.
And on the other side, what type of person will be on the Trump team wish list?
They're looking for that one person who, come hell or high water, will not vote to convict Donald Trump. Because, of course, if only one person out of 12 on the jury holds out against the conviction, then you have a mistrial. That person, of course, can't be too obvious in being willing to defend Trump, come hell or high water, because that person would then be struck by the prosecution. So the defense will be looking for signs in the person's background, in the person's belief on other topics, that they would be that reliable person who will take them all the way to the end of the trial and get Trump off the hook.
Now, we know that in the past, Trump has refused to speak under oath. Do you believe he'll testify? Can he be forced to testify?
No, I mean, in the United States, of course, no one can be forced to testify, you know, against themselves because of the potential, you know, pleading the Fifth Amendment, you know, that famous clause which protects someone against self-incrimination. I think the question will be, is the weight of evidence significant enough where the Trump team think, and more importantly, Donald Trump think, oh, look, I'm in a bit of trouble here. I'm going to need to take the stand. It's always risky for Trump to testify, as he has in pretrial depositions. There's always the risk that he can be mistaken or even, let's say, in theory, lie, thus exposing himself to perjury charges. So I don't think you see the Trump on the stand. I don't think you see Trump on the stand if the Trump team think this is going pretty well for them and there's no need to expose the former president to questioning from the prosecution.
He may well speak when he's not supposed to, however. Tell us about the gag order.
No, I mean, you know, in the run-up to this trial, Donald Trump assailed the district attorney, Alvin Bragg. He assailed the potential jury. He assailed the judge. He has repeatedly attacked the judge's daughter. And as in other trials, this has led to an order, in this case from Juan Merchan, the judge, to say, look, you can't post on social media. You can't post these abusive, potentially defamatory posts. But Trump has defied that. And even yesterday, both in his statements going into the courthouse, and as you mentioned in your package, he continued to rail against the judge. So he is risking, in addition, of course, to, you know, conviction on the immediate charges, in this case, a contempt of court charge as well, which potentially could carry a jail sentence.
Do you think that whichever way the case goes, Trump will use it as a win to get himself in front of the media, either as a victim or as a winner?
Well, you know the answer to that. I mean, Trump's going to use this trial in any case, no matter which direction it's taking legally, to try to get some advantage in the campaign, because the only way he knows is attack. And so he will try to attack while portraying himself as the victim. My question here is whether it will be so effective. First of all, this trial is not as headline in terms of its issues, despite the dramatic payment to Stormy Daniels, with whom Trump had an affair back in 2006. It is a little bit more difficult to understand the nature of the charges. And secondly, I think that Trump's attacks have increasingly exposed him, again, to that middle ground of American voters as being not quite trustworthy to have the reins of president again. I would say since Joe Biden's State of the Union address back in February, Georgina, that the narrative of Trump being in control of this election has receded. It's much more of an even race. And dare I say it, it's much more of a race that maybe will consider not only the legal issues around Donald Trump, but the real issues that concern Americans on a day-to-day basis.
I mean, can he still run for president if he's found guilty?
Absolutely. There's no provision in the Constitution that prohibits a convicted felon from running for president and from winning the election. And indeed, even if Trump was convicted in any of the other three trials, including the trial around his attempt to overturn the 2020 election leading up to the Capitol attack of January 6, 2021, if convicted of effectively trying to carry out a coup to hold on to office, he could still run for that office again.
That's extraordinary. We heard Simon Marks say that prison's unlikely. If he does lose, what do you think the sentence will be?
Well, I mean, in theory, let's reinforce that this is fairly serious. These are 34 felony charges, not misdemeanor charges, because the alleged falsification of business records is connected to an effort to intervene in, to pervert the 2016 election by keeping Stormy Daniels quiet. And I think each of those charges carries a potentially 5 years in prison. So, you know, that's a long time. But I think in practice, falsification of business records normally, upon convictions, leads to a heavy fine rather than prison.
And Scott, just to go back to what you were saying earlier, that there is no bar, if he's found guilty, to him running for president. What if he is actually put into prison? What happens then?
Then you have the scenario that on January of 2025, January 20th, 2025, when Donald Trump is supposed to take the oath of office, that will he actually be escorted from prison to appear on the steps of the U.S. Capitol to return to the White House? And that scenario, I don't think Trump will actually be in prison in January 2025. I think he'll still be out, if only on appeal. But it still raises the scenario of, can you use the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution to say that he is unfit to hold office? I can't tell you what's going to happen there because, Georgina, as so often with Donald Trump, we ain't been here before.
Scott Lucas, thanks very much indeed. Now, we're going to turn to today's papers soon, but first, let's quickly head to Italy, where the Monocle team has taken over Salone di Mobile Milano, the world's largest furniture trade fair. Well, I'm joined now from Milan by Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, that's Ed Stocker. Ed, now, I know you've got a lot on today, so I'm not going to keep you long. Just tell us about the atmosphere and what you're looking forward to today.
What am I looking forward to today? Well, there's so much going on, to be honest with you, Georgina. We have got our second day of Monocle talks at the Pinacoteca in Brera, of course, with Tyler, Andrew and Nick. So they're going to be on stage at 10 a.m. our time. There's lots of other stuff. I'm going to be seeing a new furniture label called Interni Venosta that's from the people behind Dimore Studio. So that's going to be pretty exciting. I've got a lunch with Citerio. I'm going to be seeing Bonaccina in the evening. Lueve Lamps, I think, might be calling in on Rap Studios, who were on the radio yesterday. So, yeah, it's a pretty packed thing of being around. I'm going to be mostly in the centre of Milan. And then probably the day after, head to the fairground itself.
Sounds extremely busy. I'm going to let you get back to it. Ed Stocker, thank you very much indeed. And we'll have more from Ed and the first day of Salone del Mobile later in the show. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
And now let's continue with today's newspapers. And joining me down the line is Catherine Carpenter, a correspondent and campaigner. Catherine, let's start with this last-minute resignation of the MEP Marcus Pieper. Tell us more.
Yes, news from the EU, which Politico broke last night while I was going to bed here in London. More woes basically piled on for Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. She picked the German MEP Marcus Pieper for this lucrative job as the representative of small, medium-sized businesses. It came with a hefty salary, and he was meant to start today, but resigned late last night. Now, she's been criticised for appointing him in the first place because of allegations of cronyism. They're from the same political party. Last week, over half of MEPs voted for her to rerun that selection process. Peepers hit back saying this is all about party politics, but it does pile on problems for von der Leyen. Of course, she's seeking a second term as commission president. And I mean, he's saying it's down to party politics, but really, you know, people questioning why she kind of did this in the first place. And he obviously feeling it was just untenable to take up that position.
Let's head to Australia now, where, of course, we've seen the second stabbing in 3 days. It's now this one in the church has been declared a terrorist incident. What does the Sydney Morning Herald have on that?
Yes, the latest after these two separate stabbing incidents in Australia, the news that the Wakeley incident, that's the stabbing in the church in which a bishop was attacked, has now been declared a terrorist incident with a very young boy. Now, some reports are saying he's 16, others saying he's 15 years old. But nevertheless, a young boy has been arrested. He, it turns out, was on a good behaviour bond after a separate knife attack 3 months ago. So the news there in Australia, really, that this is a terrorist attack. More details coming out all the time about this boy and his background.
Now, we've just been talking about Donald Trump earlier on the show, and he's received endorsement now from an unlikely source, Britain's shortest-serving Prime Minister Liz Truss.
Yes. She, of course, doing the rounds ahead of the publication of her new book, which is entitled 10 Years to Save the West. And it sounds like she thinks Donald Trump might be part of that saving mission. She has said that the world was safer when he was president. She said that in a BBC interview for a podcast. She says that she doesn't agree with everything Donald Trump has ever said, but she's praised his more aggressive attitude to countries like China. This book is quite extraordinary, and some of the claims she's made in the interviews while she's trying to publicise it, equally extraordinary. She's claimed that she was forced out as PM by powerful establishment figures. She's saying that she doesn't think it's fair. She's got the blame for trashing the economy, and she's made what some newspapers are saying is quite a staggering statement regarding the death of Queen Elizabeth II, where she sort of focuses on the impact on herself. She says in the book, "Why me? Why now?" is what went through her mind when she heard about the death of the Queen. So, I mean, she is doing a book round, and she's certainly giving everyone plenty of material to ensure it gets coverage.
Absolutely. I mean, there are articles here in the Spectator which asks just what Liz Truss is up to. I particularly like the headline in The Guardian, the opinion piece by Zoe Williams, "The Greatest Mystery of Modern Politics, Liz Truss's Self-Belief."
It is extraordinary. I mean, I actually don't think it's very surprising what she's up to. I think it's very clear what she's up to. She's trying to sell her book and set herself up as this, I suppose, particularly sort of right-wing conservative figure. But it'll be interesting to see if she does try and kind of make a move back into the mainstream politics. You know, will any of these comments come back to haunt her? I suspect she doesn't really mind because she's on a roll right now.
Absolutely. Finally, let's have a look at this lovely story from Japan.
Yes, I picked this one up because we all like to have a little browse in antique shops every now and then, or I certainly do. And this solid gold tea bowl was found in an antique shop in Japan. But it turns out it had been stolen from a department store which was doing a display of gold objects. And then it had been sold on to this antique shop on the same day. It's a beautiful bowl. If anyone wants to take a look online in the Japan Times, solid gold matcha bowl worth 10.5 million yen. And it was on display in this department store. And the man who allegedly took it says he was just strolled by, thought he'd sort of be able to grab it, did so, sold it on to a shop. And then it turned up in this antique shop, but it's now back with its rightful owners.
And you're right, it is very, very beautiful. Catherine, thank you very much indeed. That's Catherine Carpenter there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Australian police say a knife attack on an Assyrian church bishop and some followers in Sydney was a terrorist act motivated by suspected religious extremism, as the country reeled from a second stabbing incident in 3 days. At least four people were wounded in the attack, including Bishop Mamari Emmanuel of the Assyrian Christ the Good Shepherd Church, when a man lunged at him with a knife during a service live-streamed on Monday. South Korea's foreign ministry summoned a Japanese diplomat today to protest a claim in Japan's annual diplomatic policy Blue Book over a group of islands between the countries at the centre of a long-standing territorial row. While ties between the two have improved recently, the neighbours are at odds over the sovereignty of the islands that lie about halfway between them. And German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on a 3-day visit to China, his first since the government launched a de-risking strategy last year to avoid tethering Germany too closely to the world's second largest economy. President Xi said today two-way ties with Germany would continue to develop steadily as long as both respected each other and sought common ground while reserving differences. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Ukraine's recent attacks on Russian oil refineries have deepened tensions within the US. But can Kyiv risk a rift with the White House as Washington battles internal political divides over the war in Ukraine? It comes days after President Volodymyr Zelensky made a virtual plea to the Delphi Economic Forum for additional military aid from Western nations, stopping short of calling for troops on the ground. Monocle's team was at the event and caught up with the former commander of US Army Europe, Ben Hodges. Andrew Muller began by asking Ben whether he thinks Ukraine could win its war without the assistance of foreign troops.
Absolutely, I do. But of course, the key caveat is that they need ammunition, they need the sanctions that the West has imposed on Russia, those need to be enforced. All of those things have to happen. And you know, you remember last time we spoke, I've been an optimist about this, about Ukraine's prospects for winning. But I always caveated that by if we provide what's needed. And clearly, we in the U.S. are failing miserably right now. You can't blame it just on the Republicans, although they deserve most of the blame. The administration also has failed to make clear why this is important for the United States, that Ukraine wins. And the president has to do a much better job of that.
I mean, I do want to come back to the American political aspect of this shortly, but you alluded to it there, and there has been this suggestion from President Emmanuel Macron of France, echoed by Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, among others, and they weren't saying we will or we should or we might. They were just saying we're not going to rule it out. From where we are now, does it strike you as a completely incredible prospect that one or more NATO nations might decide to actually act on the ground in Ukraine?
Not at all. I think, first of all, what President Macron said was really important strategically. You know, it puts the Russians on the back foot a little bit. I mean, I don't know why my president over 2 years ago said no U.S. boots on the ground. Why would you say that? Even if you never intended to send somebody. I mean, that's an invitation to Russia. Whenever you tell somebody what you're not going to do. And so for President Macron to say, you know, we should not take that off the table, I thought that was very good. And it also got conversation going about it. And now it seems much more plausible, not likely, plausible. When you start thinking, well, what are we talking about? Maybe we're talking about air defenders, we're talking about engineers, communications, logistics, etc. But I tell you what, I think it is a very real possibility now, because countries, in particularly in Eastern Europe, cannot just sit at the border and hope that Russia runs out of gas before they get to Moldova or Poland or Lithuania. I wouldn't make a prediction for other countries, but I don't know how they could not get involved if it looks like Russia is going to get across the Dnipro and it's just going to keep going somehow.
So is the only reason, though, not to do that, the Russian nuclear deterrent?
I think we have been deterring ourselves out of an unnecessary fear of Russian use of a nuclear weapon for years now. I think, of course, Russia has thousands of nuclear weapons. Of course, they don't care how many innocent people might die. But there's no value for them in using a nuclear weapon. Their nuclear weapons are most effective when they don't actually use them. You know, it's the threat. Because they see how all of us are like, oh my God, they might escalate. And so I think Poland or France or Lithuania or other European countries will do what's in their best interest. If that means helping stop Russia from defeating Ukraine, I think that they will do it. The countries that are closest to Russia physically that would suffer the most from any nuclear strike are the ones that are most clear-eyed about the threat and the need to do something.
Another conflict we did speak about last time, and I do want to ask you about again, having moved on a few months, is obviously the one between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. You have, of course, an unusual insight into that as someone who has seen urban combat up close. You commanded a brigade of the 101st Airborne at the Battle of Najaf in 2003. When you look at what the IDF have done since we last spoke about this, are you surprised by how they have gone about their business in Gaza?
I'm not surprised how they've done it, because they have done this maybe not on this scale, but they have done this for many years. I think what I'm a little bit surprised about is how thus far they have pretty much dismissed criticism from the U.S. and other European countries. The countries that typically have supported Israel in the past are really, you know, my president certainly has put a lot of pressure on them, and so far I can't tell that it's had any impact. That's a little bit of a surprise to me, which means that the Netanyahu government does not take serious stern warnings coming from Secretary Blinken or President Biden. So I think the ultimate leverage is going to have to be when the U.S. says Israel cannot use any weapons or ammunition for any operations in Gaza, for example, or anything in support of illegal settlements or something that one could describe as in support of the greater Israel ideology.
But is what we're seeing at all comparable to anything you recall from Iraq? Or are they? Does it strike you that this is just the complete scorched earth approach?
Well, I mean, look, everybody in the world knows that Hamas is a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. They're brutal. And that they use innocent people as human shields. There's no denying that. But that doesn't mean that the IDF can then just go ahead and destroy entire houses without confirming that only Hamas are inside of it. You can't do that. The hundreds of weapons that have been dropped from aircraft or have been fired from artillery, you can't just do that without killing innocent people. You know, American soldiers, British soldiers, all of us in Afghanistan and Iraq had put our own guys at risk until we could confirm that only Taliban, for example, or Al-Qaeda were in a structure. Of course we made mistakes. Those are mistakes. This is a deliberate, I think, a willingness to accept a level of collateral damage because it was really worth it to get this particular guy. That's illegal. That's unacceptable. And I think it becomes very, very difficult for the government to justify it. And it's become even more difficult for friends of Israel to continue to support it.
That was the former commander of US Army Europe, Ben Hodges, in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Muller. You're with Monocle Radio. Croatians will be heading to the polls for parliamentary elections tomorrow, and it's a story of president versus prime minister. The centre-right to right-wing HDZ party is looking for a third term in power for Prime Minister Andrej Plenković, but President Zoran Milanovic has been defying a court ban on campaigning and claims he'll be Prime Minister if the centre-left coalition wins. It's all become rather personal, as our Monocle Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne reports from Croatia's capital, Zagreb.
Na zasluženih krenak, a sada 2009.
The campaign is heating up as polling day approaches in Croatia's parliamentary elections, and this children's playground in the centre of the capital, Zagreb, has become part of the political battleground. There's a sports promotion event here, but all anybody's talking about are the two big personalities involved in the election campaign, President Zoran Milanovic Milanovic, and here at this event, Prime Minister Andrei Plenković.
I think we're on the right track, and this is what we are going to explain to our citizens.
Andrei Plenković stands by his government's record, but he's worried that message is being swamped by the wild card in the election race, President Zoran Milanovic. The head of state is campaigning for the centre-left Social Democrats, despite a court ban.
It's an anti-constitutional behaviour. What is relevant that the Croats are provided with the government and with the parliamentary majority, which will ensure stability over the next 4 years and create conditions for economic growth and social cohesion.
Is it damaging for Croatia to have this sort of competition between the president and the prime minister?
Well, it's bizarre, but I'm trying to sort of minimize the negative effects of this unconstitutional acts that were committed by the president. And I mean, the Constitutional Court couldn't have been clearer. For us, it's a continuation of an odd behavior, to be very polite.
In fact, the president has electrified the campaign. Croatia's parliamentary elections tend to be predictable. The ruling HDZ has broad support and wins most of the time. But Zoran Milanovic has become the country's most popular politician since he became president 4 years ago. So announcing that he'd be the Social Democrats' candidate for prime minister meant all bets were off.
The elections were kind of already decided before that move. So it was obvious that the ruling party, HDZ, would be in position to make another new coalition quite easily.
Krešimir Macan is a political analyst and consultant.
People don't support him as a president. But what they approve him is the way he talks. Because he tells them what most of them want to hear.
And the way Zoran Milanovic talks tends to be blunt and to the point. A good example is his reaction to the Constitutional Court's ruling that he can't be part of the parliamentary campaign unless he steps down as president. Milanovic accuses the judges of doing the government's bidding.
That gangster clique has taken the court hostage. Such peasants are also illiterate. So it's a problem, because that means the decision is also illiterate.
The court ruling hasn't dampened the opposition's enthusiasm. Their poll numbers are up, with messages about corruption and the high cost of living hitting home.
The major issue, I think it's overarching, is the huge exodus of young people from Croatia.
Sandra Benčić is the leading candidate of the green-left Možemo party.
People feel that they are not being ranked in jobs, in labor market, according to their skills and their, you know, merits, but that people who are HDZ actually get the jobs or promotions or better salaries. This hopelessness that it will not change pushes people across the border, and most of them do not get back.
But there's still the concern of how a Milanovic-led government would behave. His populist outbursts insult not just the government, but people in neighbouring Bosnia. He's also praised Russia and spoken out against military aid to Ukraine. So the big question is, does he mean it?
Milanovic changed his position in the past 3 years as the head of the state. He's very far from being Social Democrat.
Jarko Buhovski is a retired professor of political philosophy and arguably the doyen of Croatia's political analysts.
You cannot really show the substantial differences between Milanovic and Plenković, and they are the two main figures in this duel.
Why does Zoran Milanovic hold the levels of popularity that he does?
People have the feeling he's the one to tell them. He had some kind of dispute with some of the Bosniak leaders in Sarajevo, and I said they want to discuss civil society in Bosnia-Herzegovina, but they first need a soap, and then perfume, and then civil society.
It's not exactly rhetoric to make the spirit soar, but the candidate who isn't a candidate remains the man to watch in this election. For Monocle in Zagreb, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Many thanks there to Guy. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
.45 here in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio, and it's time to talk tech with David Phelan, who joins us now in the studio. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning.
Now, everybody is talking about AI, except, of course, Apple, who are not talking about it. They're just not calling it AI, but that might change.
That's right. I think that is beginning to change. Up until now, they've always referred to it as machine learning, which is a sort of more modest term, and I think is exactly right. So much of AI is just a buzz phrase that you never quite understand what it means. Sometimes it just means something as simple as your photographs might look a bit better on your phone. But things are changing, obviously, with generative AI, ChatGPT and Google's Bard, or Gemini, as it's now called, AI engines, really becoming front and centre. You can now even use AI in WhatsApp in the search box to answer peculiar questions in some countries. So AI is unquestionably here, is unquestionably going to be big. Apple needs to get it together. And it looks like in June, we will hear the first big AI changes from Apple.
So that's when the Worldwide Developers Conference happens. What sort of changes are they contemplating?
Well, we don't know yet. The curious thing about generative AI is that for it to be at its most powerful, you have to speak or type or interact in with the device, which then contacts the internet, because that's where the big servers are. Apple is always very reluctant to do things like that because they are obsessed with privacy, which they call a fundamental human right. And so they want to do things on device. That's great. That means you have to have a very powerful processor. The latest iPhones, the next iPhone comes in September, will likely have a much more powerful processor to enable that. But it still limits what you can do. So it looks like they'll start off by making Siri, the voice assistant, much more powerful and much more capable and much more able to talk and listen to conversational, natural phrases rather than more complex ones.
Samsung, of course, is doing very well in this area.
Yes, they went early and they went big. In with the Galaxy S24 released in January, they introduced features like Circle to Search, where you just scribble on an image and it looks up whatever is in that picture. That's done in conjunction with Google. And a brilliant system where you can have a phone call with someone in a different language and you both hear a live translation of what the other person is saying. Great if you're wanting to feel confident about that restaurant reservation you've just made in a country you've never been to before.
It's Douglas Adams. It's Babelfish.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Tell us about Therabody.
So Therabody is a really interesting company. You'll have heard of it probably from the Theragun massage guns. Dr. Jason Worsland, whom I interviewed last week, is the founder, and he described it. It was a curious thing. He was at quite a low point in his life. He was on a motorbike going down the freeway when he, as he described it, T-boned and really damaged his neck. And he didn't want to alleviate the pain with drugs. So he went into his garage and found a reciprocating saw.
Cut his neck off.
Exactly. Put a dishcloth over the sharp bit and discovered that the percussive therapy is very effective at reducing a pain and helping recovery. And so he turned this into, over the next decade and more, his business. And now there are a bunch of new Theraguns just coming out, including one that for the first time is really super low priced, £125 in the UK. And it's really good, really quiet, works brilliantly. And then there are more advanced ones, which include infrared lights and include a heart rate monitor, so you can do calming breath exercises.
Sounds wonderful.
It is, actually.
And lots of beauty stuff as well.
Yes, yes. There's a very good face mask which uses LEDs.
Excellent. Now, let's talk about trackers, because I see you've got a bit of kit here for me to play with.
Yes, this is, I will pass it to you, this is the, from Rolling Square, the AirCard E. That, as you can see, it's a slightly thicker than normal credit card, and it goes in your wallet, and it's got a tracker in it, and it uses Apple's Find My system, which means that if you lose your wallet, you mark it as lost, and then that little device will start silently pinging every Apple device that walks past, that is carried past, and then that message is passed back to you, and it will appear on your iPhone. Rolling Square, one of the people who've come up with some great new devices in this range, and you can even see there's a little sticker you can put on. That's a unique QR code, so that then I can use it as a digital business card and tap it against your phone, and it'll send you my details. But trackers are really in the news at the moment because the AirTag, which was Apple's version of it, is very good, but some felt that it had security issues because people could pop one in your bag if they wanted to stalk you. And there are obviously safeguards to prevent that happening. If I did that to you within a few hours, that AirTag would start beeping to tell you that, and indeed your iPhone would say, you've got an AirTag, did you know? And what's happening now is Google, which has held back its own version, has just released it. It's called Find My Device, and works in a similar process with the billion or so Android phones there are on the market. And it's thought that the next thing that will happen is that both of these systems will be able to say when the other system is in your bag or in your vicinity.
So they'll be interoperable.
Yeah, exactly, yes. And there will be new devices. Pebblebee, for example, is a brand that is bringing out devices that can work with both Find My Device and Apple Find My.
So what happens, though? Somebody nicks your wallet, and the first thing they do, clearly, is chuck out your Find My Car.
Well, that's true. Well, at least you can find that again. Yes, that's true. But maybe you haven't. Maybe it hasn't been stolen. Maybe it's been lost. Maybe you left it at home and you don't know where it is. I have to say, when I left my wallet behind when I was going abroad, I discovered as I was sitting down on the plane that I'd left the wallet at home. But I knew it. Then it comes up. You can see on the iPhone a map of where it is, and then it was instantly reassured because I could see it was my home address. So.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Just before we go, I just wanted to just circle back very slightly because I feel you were a little bit dismissive about the beauty device.
I apologise. No, it's remarkable. It has multicoloured LEDs so that they can and they shine on your face in different ways. There's a massage quality to it so that you can do more and more. And it does look a bit scary when you put it on. Well, you can't see it, but other people can. But it's a very effective and it's had amazing reviews for the quality of how it can improve your skin.
So, I mean, that's laser or something?
No, it's LED, which we have everywhere, but it's different coloured LEDs because it's light therapy is what they call it.
I cannot wait to try it. Wish you'd brought one of those in.
I'm sorry, I'll bring it next time.
David Phelan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Finally, we head back to Salone del Mobile Design Week in Milan, where Monocle Radio has a pop-up studio in a prime location. As we heard earlier on the show, the team is busy behind the mics, speaking to artists and designers, including Jan Hemzel, who designs and creates expressive timber pieces in his London studio. Commissioned by the American Hardwood Export Council, Jan is making his Milan Design Week debut. In collaboration with Party, a design studio that bridges the gap between architecture, furniture and landscape, the two have created Pirouette, a collection of timber furniture that explores complex geometric forms. Let's rejoin Monocle's Ed Stocker in conversation with Jan.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for being here. This is your debut at Milan Design Week.
It is our debut at Milan Design Week, and we're very proud and excited to be here. We opened a show at the Triennale as part of a collaborative project with AHEC, which is the American Hardwood Export Council.
So how does one team up with the American Hardwood Export Council?
Well, they kind of come to you. Once you build up a reputation as a workshop, I should say we run a design workshop in London and we specialise in creating beautiful objects from timber. And in that, you get recognition. We generally make a lot of bespoke work, which is complicated. And from each project stems the next more complicated project and so on and so forth. And all our collections, essentially trying to simplify complexity in working timber. And from that, AHEC come knocking on the door because they see what we can create working with artists, working with different designers, working with our own collections. And they offer the opportunity to become the expert workshop on a project, facilitating the ideas of Giles Nardi and Eleanor Hill of Party, two amazing architectural designers. And then, yeah, we went in cold and blind. We said we'd do the project. We didn't know what was going to be designed and what we were going to develop. We had 4 months, and here we are. We did it. We built the impossible.
I mean, obviously, you've got the AHEC.
Yep.
You've also got the collaboration with Party Design Studio and yourself. So was everyone on the same page, I guess, in terms of this project from the beginning?
Yeah, so from very early on, when the call came in, David said we'd like to do this project. We said, yeah, engaged in a meeting just before Christmas. You know, instantly we even got on. Evan came to the workshop so we could show them what we were capable of, how we work and how we think. And then it was over to the designers to kind of go, okay, like we know what these guys are capable of. So they had a free rein to kind of design. And Giles had an open sketchbook literally as he came and said, can I make this design? And we were like, yeah, of course. Like, it looks mad, it's complicated. So we're kind of on board. And Eleanor had the same brief, but not. She didn't have anything ready to go in the sketchbook. So she went away and really thought about what we could develop and do together. And she came up with a really beautiful idea called Pirouette. And it was based on the movement of fabric. So, yeah, from very early on, we all got on pretty quick. And it's what we needed. It was a 3-month workshop time, 4 months project, 3 months of workshop time to develop two pretty insane projects, all from solid timber.
And were you doing things that you hadn't done before? Were you asked to sort of, because I know this Pirouette is trying to be quite boundary pushing, it's got
especially in solid timber, but nonetheless, when you don't know what's coming, there's a set deadline. When someone says it's Milano, then you know there's no extension of time, so you're like, okay, there's a real tight constraint on this time. So Giles' project was kind of set in stone. We kind of knew it was some development and we got going and the techniques were in the bag with us and it was just on scale. Eleanor's came late in the day and it was a big one. When she dropped like what we thought she was going to do and then what she came and said, this is what I'd like to do, it was a bit like, okay, this is interesting. And, you know, it was not alarming, but we're like, fuck, we've only got a couple of months to make this. And the shapes are getting very sculptural, very large. But once you start digesting a project, then you simplify the process, break it down, and you can make it happen.
And how is the craft of like working and designing with wood in the UK?
How is the craft?
Yeah, is it alive and kicking? Is it in a healthy condition?
I'd say so. I think my window in the world of like design is very much biased towards furniture design and makers. But I'm also very aware of like artists and sculpture and how that works. And so like, it's a very small niche window that I look at what I do in terms of design. And I think, yeah, you know, it's a big bustle. Like people work timber. I think there's a lot of people that work solid timber. But maybe when I look a bit in a broader perspective, there's not that many people who like really master the craft of it. There's a limited few people that really continually work just in solid and put that together. So it's quite interesting to see like a project like AHEC, who's a really interesting client, because their job is to like push the boundaries of what you can do with their timber. So when they come to you, it's quite exciting as a studio who's developing and pushing the craft in what is capable in timber. So I feel like sometimes at points we're pushing it, and then by that we're bringing everyone up, because we're showing the possibilities that, yeah, you can do this. It's possible, it's tricky, it's complex. You need a solid team and a good set of backing between good clients, but you can achieve amazing things.
Designer Jan Hetzel there. And that's all for this programme. Thanks to our producers Vincent McAvinney and Laura Kramer, our researcher George Ruskin, and our studio manager Christy O'Grady, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. More music on the way. The briefing is at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.